From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of a pre-recorded episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Professor Francis Beckwith, author of Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Dr. Beckwith in their conversation.
Think about something like freedom of speech. It wasn't unusual to hear people say things like, I don't agree with what that fellow's saying over there, but I will defend his right to say it, right? That kind of thinking is vanishing. And you'll hear things like, well, you know, I don't like what that person says. It makes me feel bad. I think the government or the social media company should silence him. And when you say to people, well, don't you believe in freedom of speech? They're not embarrassed to say, no, I don't. Well, they've not understood, never been taught why freedom of speech is good, why we need it, why sometimes we have to tolerate speech that we don't agree with, just like we tolerate religions we don't agree with. Because what's the alternative? A tyranny. But it also is grounded in something else Adams and some of the other founders had written about, and that is that these liberties allow us to find the good. So James Madison, in his famous letter called Memorial and Remonstrance, which was a pamphlet that he wrote to argue against the paying of Christian teachers out of the Virginia Treasury, and his argument was that the government should stay out of the church and the church out of the government because human beings should be free to worship God, because who knows, your neighbor could actually be right about something and you can learn from him. So ultimately, these rights are grounded in, you know, a good greater than those particular goods. And it's something that I think today it's become very foreign to the way a lot of people think about fundamental rights.
You know, you said a couple of things that tempt me to go on a tangent, and I think I will. You mentioned just a few moments ago that the church oftentimes is not considered to be essential. So casinos and strip clubs are considered essential, but the church isn't considered essential. And I was thinking about what you were saying, and then you mentioned Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas. So here's the tangent. You know, Thomas Aquinas had an experience in church. And as you mentioned, I mean, this is someone to be revered. He was developing his Summa. He was trying to codify all truth into a coherent whole, a truth from anthropology and from science and from ethics and psychology and from political theory and so forth. And then he had a Eucharistic encounter with the real presence of God that radically rearranged his priorities. And I think that points to something. It points to just how essential the church is in a liberal democracy. And I think about Taiwan, for example. Taiwan is one of the developed nations that did the very best with coronavirus. Well, they had been down this road before. They had SARS. And so when coronavirus came along, they didn't panic. They didn't lock down. But I found it very interesting that Buddhist temples remained open, but many churches closed down. Mm-hmm. Eucharistic assemblies closing down. They did it not because the government tried to close them down. They did it because they wanted to close down. They thought it was best. So here you have a country that is not enforcing a lockdown, but the churches sort of enforce that lockdown on themselves. And I think this has something to say about how we have depreciated just how essential the church is in any nation, much less in developed nations.
Yeah, and I think it has a lot to do with the role that an individual or let's say a church thinks about the faith. So think of you mentioned Aquinas' experience. I just wanted to jump back to that for a second. I mean, he was right in the middle of the writing the Summa Theologica when he had that, and afterwards he told his assistant, everything I've written up to this time is just straw. And he never wrote again after that. That's how profound that experience was for Aquinas. But if you go back to the way in which the founders thought about religion, I mentioned earlier Madison's Moral Remonstrance. For him, one's relationship to God was likened to being under another sovereign. And so he saw that one's religious liberty wasn't like a matter of choice, per se. So let me explain what I mean here. When I say, for example, I can't engage in an activity that violates my conscience, I'm not saying I don't want to do it. I'm saying I can't do it. And it's because I'm under the authority of the sovereign I did not choose. But in American culture, and I think this is widely thought of, I think even in societies, even though they're not historically Western, they've been influenced by Western mores concerning religion. You mentioned the churches in Taiwan, that somehow religion or going to church is sort of another commodity. You know, it's as if you choose your religion like you choose, you know, your toilet paper and your grape juice when you go to the supermarket. And the American founders thought that, obviously, they knew people converted from one faith to another, but they didn't think of it as a matter of like pure volition, that people were oftentimes moved by conscience. They were oftentimes swayed as a result of what we would say is like a movement of the Holy Spirit. They knew Quakers. They knew that there were people like this, and that for this reason, the government should make it as difficult as possible or try to craft laws in a way so that church and state conflict as little as possible. But the willingness of churches to acquiesce so quickly, I think, is the result of just religion as just a kind of, you know, something that's done on Sunday, right? And that there is really nothing per se special about the building or the activities that go on there. And you can just sort of watch them online. And I think the people in the government see that. And there obviously have been exceptions. There have been several lawsuits throughout the United States over some of the lockdown measures. But I think the view of religion as almost like a kind of hobby is the way in which I think many elected officials think of faith.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I mean, it's the difference between church and church life. You know, church properly understood, ecclesia, is not just something that you go to in hobby fashion, but rather it is a life, and therefore it cannot be treated lightly. There's so much I want to get to, and one of the things I was thinking about as well is something emblazoned on my own mind, something that President Theodore Roosevelt said. He said that every thinking man, when he thinks at least, realizes that the teachings of Scripture are so interwoven with our whole civic and social life that it'd be literally impossible for us to figure what life would be if those teachings were removed. We'd lose almost all the standards by which we now judge both public and private morals, all the standards to which we, with more or less resolution, strive to raise ourselves. So this matter that we've been talking about, the significance of the church, the significance of holy tradition, the significance of the Holy Scriptures is not to be trivialized. It is to be underscored, and particularly in a discussion like the discussion we're having today. But I want to talk about liberal democracy and why liberal democracy cannot be pure democracy. This seems to be a sticking point for people today. People want to get rid of the Electoral College. They want to pack the courts. There's so many things going on in our culture that are terrifying to me. Explain to our audience, as only you can, why a liberal democracy cannot be a pure democracy.
Well, it's because tyranny can be manifested not only by, you know, one individual like a dictator, can also be the result of majorities that may perceive the destruction of minorities in their interest. And this is why we have, in our form of government, kind of different levels at which representation is manifested in order to, on the one hand, allow consent of the governed, which is a kind of shorthand way of referring to the pure democracy that is individuals voting on representatives. But we also have courts. We also have a divided government, not only between the different branches of the federal government, but the different state governments.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Francis Beckwith. The role of Christians in the political process is hotly contested. Citing separation of church and state, many critics believe that Christians should set aside their beliefs before they enter the public square. However, as Francis Beckwith argues in his book, Politics for Christians, followers of Christ have a rich heritage of sophisticated thought and a crucial responsibility to contribute to the shaping of public policy. To receive your copy of Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft, just give us a call at 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit us at equip.org. Are you the product of millions of years of unguided, purposeless natural processes? Or are you created in the image of a loving God? Faced with the overwhelming scorn of evolutionary proselytizers, it can be hard to articulate the truth about God's creative work. And even among faithful Christians, many misconceptions linger. The Creation Answer book by Hank Hanegraaff puts answers to the most hotly debated origins questions right at your fingertips, giving you clarity and understanding. Learn to articulate the truth about our origins clearly and compassionately when you request your copy of the Creation Answer book or listen to Hank's insightful answers with the unabridged audiobook version on CD. Receive your copy of the Creation Answer book or the audiobook on CD from the Christian Research Institute when you call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Bertrand Russell famously said, "Most people would rather die than think, and many of them do." Not so with CRI support team members. Support team members are not only serious thinkers, but their membership in CRI's support team helps to equip hundreds of thousands of fellow believers around the globe each and every month. Are you not a member? Then you're missing out. Not only do support team members form the backbone of Christian Research Institute's outreaches, but they enjoy their selection of resources from our Equipping Essentials library and receive a complimentary subscription to CRI's award-winning Christian Research Journal, just two of the benefits of membership. To discover how you can make a difference 24/7 in equipping believers at home and abroad to stand for life and truth, check out the benefits of membership at equip.org.
According to Politics for Christians by Francis Beckwith, a candidate who embraces Christian ideals, even if he or she is not a Christian, is a candidate that a Christian can support with a clear conscience. Christians in America have the historically unique power to enact laws that advance the common good and must take this special obligation seriously by using good judgment while voting and supporting legislation and political candidates. This is not to say that Christians will always agree on what policies and candidates represent the best option to advance the common good, but there is no doubt that Christians have a biblical mandate to advance it. To receive your copy of Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org.
Let's rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and Dr. Francis Beckwith in their conversation.
Explain to our audience why a liberal democracy cannot be a pure democracy.
Well, it's because tyranny can be manifested by majorities, majorities that may perceive the destruction of minorities in their interest. And this is why we have, in our form of government, different levels at which representation is manifested in order to, on the one hand, allow consent of the governed, but we also have courts, we also have a divided government, not only between the different branches of the federal government, but the different state governments. And it's also because, if you think about what exactly is the point of the government, right? Well, the point of the government is to allow our common lives to be exercised in a just and fair manner. And the fact is that there are a variety of different communities within different geographical regions, right? They're widely diverse, right? I live in Central Texas, which is much different than Los Angeles or Charlotte or Hibbing, Minnesota. These are widely different places, right, with different traditions and histories. If, in fact, let's say you had this sort of crude democracy, right? We vote on everything all the time, and let's say we eliminate something like the Electoral College so that whoever's elected president, you know, just gets the pure majority or plurality vote, right? Well, what happens in terms of the wide diversity of communities? Now, imagine if today we didn't have the Electoral College. Do you think that, well, of course, this is an odd year anyway, so, but imagine if we didn't have COVID-19 and the candidates were campaigning. Would you think they'd campaign? Would they spend any time in Iowa or some rural community in Wisconsin? No, they would just go to those places that are the most populated, right, where you had, you know, all the big industries, all the people who had the most money, right? So what you would get, ironically, is less diversity. You'd have, in a way, less representation, right? You would have, the focus would just be on those areas of the country that were the most densely populated. And why would a politician want to waste his time going to Montana or Idaho or, you know, the rural parts of, say, northern Tennessee, right? But when you have, I think with something like the Electoral College, kind of recognition that there are geographical differences and that, yes, individuals are equal before the law, but the fact is that we have just a wide range of different types of communities that have different types of industries, different cultures and traditions, and so forth. So I think, I don't know if that adequately explains it, but there's a couple of different things going on in our republic. One has to do with, again, consent of the governed, right? So there's the democratic part of it, but also acknowledgement of just the differences that we have. And if we just had a pure democracy, you would not have the restraints on government action. Imagine if the courts were, you know, simply under the authority of majority rule. Is it perfect? Absolutely, it's not. But today, like, we have an individual that was appointed by President Trump, Amy Coney Barrett. The president, whomever he happens to be, appoints somebody to the Supreme Court, but the person doesn't make it to the court just like that. He or she has to go through the U.S. Senate. The Senate has to confirm that individual, and that individual will go through, as we saw last week, a sort of battery of questions and interrogation, and people may not like that, but that's part of the process. And these particular processes are put in place so that tyranny becomes less likely.
You know, Frank, I think it is so important for people to take the time to digest your book, Politics for Christians, because, I mean, I can foresee a time. I couldn't maybe 10 years ago when you originally wrote the book, but I can foresee a time today where you have major politicians urging us to get rid of the Electoral College, politicians talking about packing the courts. I can see that becoming a reality in our lifetimes. I honestly couldn't see this 10 years ago, but now you can see it. And it's so important for us to understand how we could easily degenerate into mob rule if we get rid of these aspects of our liberal democracy that make it so brilliant, so poignant, so profound, such an arbiter of liberty.
Yeah, and what people don't realize is that we're called the United States of America, right? We have these political jurisdictions we call states, and the United States consists of not only its citizens, but citizens that live in the particular states, and those states themselves have interests, right? So if you eradicate that, if you eradicate the distinctions between the states and just make them no different than really large neighborhoods, I think you're right, Hank. I mean, you're fundamentally changing the nature of this country, and I think it's going to change the way people obviously run for president. So, you know, we've had now, I think, since 2000, how many? Two elections where the individual that won the Electoral College did not win the
popular vote. Yeah.
Or the popular vote. So you'll hear, well, so-and-so didn't win the popular vote, but nobody campaigned for the popular vote. You know, they campaigned for the electoral vote. So that's a really unfair characterization, right? So, you know, going back to 2000, Bush versus Gore, right? That was the first in my lifetime of somebody losing the popular vote and winning the election. And so, oh, you know, Gore won the popular vote. Well, no, he won the collection of all the votes that was the result of campaigning for the Electoral College. I mean, it would be almost like saying, oh, you know, let's say the Dodgers win the World Series. Yeah, the Dodgers may have won 4 out of 6 games, but the Rays got more runs. You know, you wouldn't.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah, the way the game is played is that it's each game, right? So if the game had been played differently, if, let's say, the Dodgers and the Rays were told, you're going to play 50 innings in a row, and whoever gets the most runs at the end wins, okay, that's the game. But the game here is you're trying to win states, right? Because we are the United States of America. So in any event, I think that people don't appreciate that, even though the Electoral College, yeah, once in a while, the person who doesn't win the popular vote wins the Electoral College. But that is the result of the way the game is played. If it had been played differently, who knows what might have happened? We just don't know.
I want you to talk about natural rights and natural moral law, because liberal democracy assumes natural rights. And if we didn't have this assumption, it would have a dramatic impact on things like the abolition of slavery or racism and the like. So this is a very significant issue that you tackle in your book.
Yeah, so let me just define what I mean by natural rights and natural law. So the kind of example that virtually all your listeners would be aware of is the claim in the Declaration of Independence, where Jefferson says that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, including the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What he's essentially saying there, and if you read the rest of it, he talks about the role that the government plays in protecting those fundamental rights. That idea is not something obviously unique to Jefferson or newly introduced. It goes way back. In fact, even in the early days of the church, right, there were Roman writers that talked to us, including Cicero, who talked about what we would call natural law. Paul the Apostle himself brings up this understanding in Romans. I actually think Jesus presupposes it in some of his sermons. He says, would a good father give his son, you know, a scorpion and say that it's a loaf of bread, right? He assumes that people know what a good father is, right? So basically what the natural law is, there are certain fundamental goods that human beings are ordered toward by nature that we can use our reason to judge about. So think about something like life. We're ordered towards life. Now, we're ordered towards it as a good. And it's sometimes difficult to grasp. You think, well, how do I know that that is what I ought to do? And the example I use in class is I ask my students, imagine if you heard of somebody, let's say a friend or a relative who took his own life. What would be the first question you asked? They would say, why? Why did he do it? What if your friend said, oh, I saw Fred walking across the campus? You wouldn't ask why he was alive. You wouldn't say, well, why is he doing that? Why is he alive? It's because you already assume that he is ordered towards the good of life.
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Be sure to tune in again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Francis Beckwith. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand the life-changing outreaches of the Christian Research Institute, Hank would like to send you Dr. Beckwith's book, Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write to CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The preceding program was pre-recorded. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. Are you the product of millions of years of unguided, purposeless natural processes? Or are you created in the image of a loving God? Faced with the overwhelming scorn of evolutionary proselytizers, it can be hard to articulate the truth about God's creative work. And even among faithful Christians, many misconceptions linger. The Creation Answer book by Hank Hanegraaff puts answers to the most hotly debated origins questions right at your fingertips, giving you clarity and understanding. Learn to articulate the truth about our origins clearly and compassionately when you request your copy of the Creation Answer book or listen to Hank's insightful answers with the unabridged audiobook version on CD. Receive your copy of the Creation Answer book or the audiobook on CD from the Christian Research Institute when you call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org.